Welcome to the Principled Podcast, brought to you by LRN. The Principled Podcast brings together the collective wisdom on ethics, business and compliance, transformative stories of leadership, and inspiring workplace culture. Listen in to discover valuable strategies from our community of business leaders and workplace changemakers.
With escalating risks becoming more severe and frequent globally, ethics and compliance initiatives are intensifying their focus on risk mitigation. LRN's 2024 Ethics and Compliance Program Effectiveness Report, drawing insights from over 1,400 E&C professionals worldwide, underscores this trend. Amidst this evolving risk landscape, how are E&C programs adapting? What are the prevailing strategies, and how do they manifest in everyday program operations? Our research highlights the effectiveness of values-driven programs. Not only do these programs exhibit superior effectiveness, they also demonstrate a robust correlation with diminished risks and improved business performance. Hi, and welcome to LRN's Principled Podcast. I'm your host, Emily Miner, Vice President of Advisory Services at LRN. Today, I'm joined by Nicole Diaz, Global Head of Integrity and Compliance Legal at SNAP. Today, we're going to discuss key findings from the North America edition of our 2024 Ethics and Compliance Program Effectiveness Report and explore how these findings show up at SNAP. We'll also go over different approaches to risk management and considerations for your own practice. Nicole, thanks for joining me again on the Principled Podcast.
Great. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a little bit of background. Can you tell our listeners who SNAP is and your role within the organization?
Yeah, so SNAP is the maker of Snapchat, which if you have kids, you might be a little too familiar with. And we are a global public company operating in over 25 different countries. I've been at the company for about 6 years. I actually started in litigation and doing some ethics and compliance, and have switched over to ethics and compliance full-time for about the last 4 years.
Yeah, my kids, I think, are a little too young for Snapchat at the moment, but I'm not too many years off. So there are many insights from the 2024 report, far more than we could cover in this conversation. So let's start with one of the headlines. We found that by a 10 percentage point margin, mitigating risk was the top area of focus for North American programs to improve last year. And indeed, this was true across all countries that we surveyed. For me, kind of at first blush, this seems obvious, right? Like a key purpose of an ethics and compliance program is to mitigate risk. And of course, as we know, programs should be grounded in their risk profile, as the DOJ makes clear. But what was really interesting is we've actually been asking this question for a few years now, and risk management has historically been lower down the list when we've asked this question. So last year, for example, programs were much more focused on training and communications in terms of their top priorities. But I think if we, you know, think about the last few years, we can draw a line between a number of factors. We've got increased regulatory action and requirements. We've got geopolitical events. We have the emergence of new technologies like generative AI. Of course, we never have a shortage of high-profile compliance failures. So we can draw a line between these events and this increased focus on risk. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about how this theme plays out in your organization and, you know, whether that's how your thinking around risk management has evolved in the past years, you know, maybe starting with the basics of how you think about risk assessment.
Well, I've definitely seen that shift in the tech industry in the last few years, where I think before there was sort of an attitude towards ethics and compliance of just enough to kind of say, don't do bad things to people, and maybe an over-reliance on, you know, policies or training. But I think increasingly companies are, you know, in the tech industry in particular, realizing we have to do more and we have to think in advance about potential negative impacts and mitigate those up front. But more broadly, I think that's just a sophisticated approach of any compliance program. I mean, training and comms is really the tail of the dog. You want to start as our evaluation of corporate compliance programs states, right, with an effectively designed program. And in order to do that, you need to have a risk assessment in place. And, you know, risk assessment is really going to help you understand what are the risks that your business is facing across all compliance subject matter areas. How might that risk manifest for your business in particular, right? So you take it from the general down to specifics. And then what measures, what controls do you have in place to actually stop that behavior? It's training and comms, again, are really generally ineffective ways, I think, to mitigate risk. People take a training, they don't pay attention, they forget what they've learned. What you want to do is really get, again, sophisticated about thinking about the systems and controls and processes that your organization has and how to put in blockers, how to put in reminders, how to create workflows that incorporate risk into people's everyday business activities. And that's certainly the direction that we take here at Snap and where, you know, our efforts are focused. I think one interesting thing, and we'll probably touch upon this multiple times as we talk, is sort of this idea, you know, I've talked to so many people about risk assessments, and there's so many different ways to approach it. And very, you know, people can mean a lot of different things when they say risk assessment. I think some of them can be very narrowly focused on really just kind of deeper dive, almost like an audit of the compliance program risk areas. But I think, you know, any compliance program should also consider doing a much more holistic risk assessment where you are developing a prioritization and understanding of all compliance risks, whether or not your team owns them or not. And I think that's going to give your organization the ability to really effectively mitigate risk, because you're going to be looking at everything all together and being able to spot those gaps and work effectively with cross-functional partners to mitigate those risks.
When we were prepping for this conversation, I want to pick up on that last point that you just made. One of the things that we talked about was in this body of research, you know, that really covers a lot of ground, you know, what's potentially missing. And that cross-functional collaboration is one point that you highlighted, which I think is well taken. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that a cross-functional collaboration can play into advancing an ENC program's, you know, goals and impact, from, you know, partnering with effectively with HR, you know, let's say around, you know, incorporating ethical conduct into performance management decisions, to partnering with them on investigations, to, you know, partnering with InfoSec. We could go down the list. But what you were just highlighting was that holistic approach to a risk assessment, and including the areas that your function maybe doesn't control. But if you are to really carry out that, you know, overarching mandate of protecting the organization, mitigating risk, and incentivizing ethical conduct, you're required to consider those risks, right? Like, you can't just focus on anti-bribery and corruption or what have you. And so how have you approached that with other, you know, stakeholders within Snap in taking a more holistic view of your overall risk profile?
All about relationships, as people often say. And one, you know, I think building those relationships both formally and informally has been very helpful. You know, at the start of those conversations, you might think, well, okay, I'm over here in my subject matter area, bribery, corruption, conflict of interest. They're over there in their subject matter area, you know, HR compliance, cybersecurity risk. What do we really have to talk about? And I think over time, you discover you have quite a lot to talk about. There's many points of crossover, but you need some time to, you know, develop that understanding and develop that working relationship. A formal way that I've developed those relationships is the Risk and Compliance Committee. And, you know, we've tried different ways, and I've heard of different models of setting that committee up. What I found to be very effective is composing it of risk owners, second line risk owners. So people who are senior, but still, you know, in the weeds in terms of understanding their risk areas, the controls and programs that they have in place. So we have people from privacy, from tax, from HR compliance, from security, all across the company, and who come together and, you know, share updates on insights from our various programs and also spot issues in our operations and our processes that do cross, cut across those cross-functional lines. And so I think that committee has been really instrumental to getting all of us to think about compliance risk, I think, in the way that the DOJ sees it, right? The DOJ, their evaluation of effective compliance programs, they don't talk about programs plural. They say, what is your company's compliance program like? And I've had discussions with, you know, former members of the DOJ who have said that is not limited by subject matter area. They are really looking at the holistic fabric of a company's compliance efforts, and they expect those partners to be working together to develop a very strong, unified approach to compliance risk. So I think the Risk and Compliance Committee is a great place to start those relationships in a formal way. Risk assessment that we're talking about, you know, then is a way for all of you to come together and develop a really clear understanding of the risks that you're managing together and the programs you all have in place. And then informally, you know, being able to have conversations with those people. What are they seeing? What are they worried about? What do they think the company is doing well or not well? And understanding that you're all kind of coming at this from a similar perspective.
You know, as you were just sharing about the compliance committee, I was thinking about the debate that's been playing out in the ethics and compliance space over the last few years around ESG oversight and where does that sit? And there's a camp that say it fits naturally within the ethics and compliance function, maybe not to be responsible for all of the parts, but to have that oversight. And then there's another camp that says, you know, no way, my plate is too loaded as it is. That's for somebody else to do. And I'm not going to weigh in on, you know, one side or the other right now. But I was just thinking about this committee-based approach that you have. If we, you know, going back to what you highlighted around the DOJ having that singular program, not programs. I mean, that's really what's required if an organization is going to, you know, have a handle on all the different types of compliance risks in an organization. It's too much for one individual or one function. Does that expertise all sit, of course, within one individual or one function? So seeing a parallel there to this debate around ESG.
ESG is actually part of compliance at SNAP. So, you know, I don't think it has to sit there, but I certainly think that there's a lot of crossover and it is a good relationship to build amongst the others that I was discussing.
So you've talked about your observations in how the risk assessment has evolved over time and a little bit about how you're thinking about that in SNAP. But risk assessment is, you know, of course, just one piece of the overall risk management puzzle. So what are some other, you know, thinking about your risk management more broadly, either in the tech industry or at SNAP, what are some other pieces of that puzzle that you find valuable to manage your risks?
Other pieces, I think, are policy enforcement and investigations. So I think, you know, sometimes there can be a lot of teams at a company who are struggling to get people to comply with a policy. You know, they may not be ready to jump to, okay, we're going to report you to compliance. But I think even at those early stages where they're trying to figure out, you know, their enforcement scheme, that can be a good place for you to, you know, come in, partner with those teams, and also to learn about where are the major areas of noncompliance in the company. And how do we increase compliance? And what does it say that we're having trouble with that particular policy? And then investigations, if it does lead to investigation or there is a reported concern, is a great time to develop stronger relationships with those policy owners. I will often alert policy owners and involve them if there is a reported issue, because I view them as the, you know, owner of that area of risk. And so they should be looped into understanding the enforcement process. And then root cause analysis at the end of an investigation, once you're done and, you know, you've adjudicated the particular corrective action for that individual, you know, there's still so many great insights and learning opportunities for the company. And I think that's an opportunity for compliance to work with those risk owners and to think about, okay, how can we, again, mitigate risk, right? How can we ensure that these, that controls are set up to minimize this sort of behavior going forward?
One of the questions that we asked in our research was around, you know, different sources of input of data and trying to rank order the helpfulness, the usefulness of a particular source of insight in terms of working to advance program effectiveness, program goals, et cetera. And root cause analysis rose up higher than straight just hotline, you know, hotline reports and trends. And that caused some discussion internally around what that meant. And, you know, I'm curious to get your reaction, but the way that I interpreted that was that hotline, and it was specific to hotline, like that captures such a small sliver of what's going on in an organization. And of course, it's a very important source of information, but it still does tend to capture a smaller sliver than a broader case management system would. And so the root cause analysis of those compliance failures or control failures or whatever the case may be can be a more powerful tool to figure out what potentially needs to be fixed. But I don't know if you have thoughts on kind of hotline reports versus root cause analysis and maybe how you view them or use them.
I mean, good for different things, I think. I think hotline reports can give you a sense of problem areas within the company, whether or not it's departments or policies that need more attention. But I think root cause analysis is where you look for systemic issues. You think, okay, we had this one report, but you know, what conclusions do we draw from that, right? What patterns are we seeing and how do we fix those? So it's more of a proactive approach.
So I want to switch gears a little bit, shift away from kind of risk assessment, risk management, and talk about another key finding from our research, which was the, you know, I think it's fair to say the really the widespread incorporation of values, of company values into the fabric of an ethics and compliance program. And we found that 82% of North American ethics and compliance professionals indicated that their organization emphasizes values as a key motivator of ethical behavior. And this is a really significant increase, 29 percentage points from when we first asked this type of question in 2016. So, you know, we're coming up on, you know, nearly 10 years of this type of data. You know, the role of values, not just rules. I think you sort of alluded to this a little bit in the beginning when we were talking about, you know, training and communications, but I know that values are really central to your program at SNAP. Your code of conduct, for example, is wrapped around one of your core values, that of being kind. So I'm wondering if you can kind of share your reaction to this finding.
That makes total sense to me. I revised our, you know, code of conduct about, you know, 3-4 years ago based on that exact philosophy. There's a lot of behavioral psychology and science research out there showing that identity and values are actually the deepest part of our what drives behavior. If you think of an iceberg, identity is like the giant part of the iceberg under the water, and rules and are sort of what's sticking out above the water. And so, you know, the values also drive the rules, right? They drive how we interpret those rules, how we enforce them. And so, you know, tying your compliance and ethics program to identity, you know, who are we? How do we behave? Is much more effective at driving behavior than just giving people a bunch of rules to memorize. It's also, I think, more flexible. If you have, you know, a rules-based system, you enter into a world where people might say, well, that's not written anywhere, or that's not, you know, this is a new scenario. And so it's not captured by the rules because you didn't anticipate it. Whereas if you have a values-based system, people understand when they are presented with new situations, they should act in a way that reflects the values of the company and use good judgment. They're expected, they understand that that's expected of them. So it's much more, ethics is a much more flexible system than a set of rules.
Yeah, I, you know, three cheers to that. That's definitely very much a central part of LRN and how our mission and how we approach our work with organizations. So it's been really interesting to track this over time. As you've just talked about, like seeing values as really central to your program. And I love the way that you framed it as tying your program to identity and to who we are as an organization. So, you know, we're seeing values become more and more integrated into that why and that how of ethics and compliance programs. But our research, you know, kind of a dark spot in our research was this apparent hole when it comes to middle management kind of role modeling the same. So when asked, 76% of our respondents said that they see executive and senior leadership making decisions consistent with values, with purpose. And they compared that to only 39% of middle management. That's a 37 percentage point difference. And it's the largest gap since we started collecting data on this in 2021. And, you know, it's particularly alarming because middle managers, as you know, those with whom most employees are directly interacting, they're very visible role models. You know, they cast an outsized shadow on the way things work around here, the culture of an organization. And of course, as the DOJ and their evaluation of corporate compliance programs note, middle managers play a key role in balancing business goals with ethical conduct. What is your reaction to this finding? Were you surprised by that? Were you, you know, is this that sort of reflective of what you understand to be true in the various organizations that you've worked in? And how are you trying to close that gap if there is one at SNAP?
The size of the gap was very surprising to me, of how stark your results were, because I think there, as you said, there's like 75% felt, you know, that their senior leaders were able to effectively make decisions based on values and ethics, whereas the gap for middle managers was so much lower. And, you know, trying to explain that gap to myself, I thought, you know, maybe this is really that middle managers feel less empowered to take a principled stand. And they view those decisions as above their pay grade. And so they get escalated up the chain. And it's not the worst system in the world, but I don't think it's an ideal system for a couple of reasons. You know, one, maybe they don't escalate it, right? Maybe they just do the decision that will make their quota, that will hit their numbers, that won't cause ripples or draw attention to them. And so, you know, they might be afraid to even raise the issue. The second thing is you then end up with an organization where the senior leaders are being pinged all the time, right, for decisions that presumably could be made at the middle manager level if managers were properly empowered and understood the risk tolerance of the organization and the ethical principles of the organization. And then third, I think you'd probably have better morale and stronger sense of belonging and commitment throughout your employee population if people understood, hey, if I take a principled stand on this, I'm going to be backed by my manager or by my leader. And everyone here is an ethical leader and should be making those decisions on behalf of the company. You know, I would love to close that gap. And I think it's probably an issue, you know, at all companies to see that number reduced and to really focus on those middle managers in the frontline defense as, you know, not just rule followers, but ethical leaders who can make those decisions.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's an element of that that comes back to the greater flexibility that you get with a values-based system as opposed to a rules-based system that you were just talking about. You know, when everybody understands the values and what we mean, you know, not just the values, like this is the word, but what does it actually mean to behave in a way that demonstrates those values, where we're all better equipped to bring them into the decisions that we're making and the actions that we're taking on a daily basis, and also for that middle management group to feel more empowered to, you know, to champion them, as you said. And, you know, this is something that I think about a lot, how to kind of tap into that middle management cohort in an organization, you know, sort of, we know there's a lot of research that I think pretty definitively shows that most people, when they have a concern, an ethics concern or a question, they're going to go to their manager. You know, they're far more likely to go to their manager than to call the hotline, for example. And so it really, I think, underscores how important it is that middle managers, you know, are supported. They understand, they have the appropriate, the training, the resources, the authority, the support to respond appropriately in a way that is in alignment with organizational values, but also just, you know, to borrow one of Snap's values, in a way that is kind, in a way that is, you know, validating and respectful to the employee raising the concern, so that you create this virtuous feedback loop. And I think the Department of Justice also recognizes that the important role of middle managers, you know, in the 2023 update, you know, there was more kind of mention of middle management than in years prior. So it's something that I think we all know is really important, and that's good. You know, it certainly is a space to watch and to share practices and, you know, what's been successful across organizations in engaging with those middle managers as ethics champions.
Yeah, it'd be interesting in follow-up surveys that LRM might do to see if you can probe if people have an understanding of the reason for that gap, right? Why do they feel managers are not empowered to make ethical decisions at this moment?
So, Nicole, I want to close our conversation by looking ahead. It was really exciting for us. 2024 marks the 10th year that we've been publishing our Ethics and Compliance Program Effectiveness Report. And so I'm wondering if you could think about the next 10 years of ethics and compliance, or just the next year, and what sort of developments do you hope to see ethics and compliance tackle, you know, in the next year or the next 10 years?
Well, I think next year, this is a doable goal. I would love to see the evaluation of corporate compliance programs updated to clearly define what they mean by a company's compliance program, and have that definition encompass all subject matter areas, not just bribery and corruption. I think that's the current intent of the document, but it doesn't state that anywhere. And I think that really making it clear that the government's view is of a unified approach to compliance, and the role of the CCO in sort of helping to generate that alignment would be very helpful.
Yeah, so kind of going back to what we were talking about at the top with respect to overall risk assessment and risk management.
And then the other thing, you know, looking further out, you know, maybe 10 years down the road, is I would love to see compliance further embedded into organizational decision making and planning. So similar, you know, along the lines of what we just said, there's middle management, right? Understanding how to make risk decisions, understanding kind of, you know, a firmer grasp on their role and kind of the ethical protections of a company, and, you know, in strategic planning and decision making, to continue to have compliance embedded into those decisions, I think is the, you know, again, focusing on risk mitigation from the get-go rather than training and comms after the fact.
Well, thank you, Nicole. You know, we're already thinking about the questions that we want to ask for the research that goes into next year's report. So I'll be taking these notes, and then, you know, maybe we'll have another conversation in a year's time, and we'll report on the progress that's been made in this particular area.
Great. Well, I really very much appreciate the insights from this year's report. And thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely, Nicole. I always love our conversations. So to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning into the Principled Podcast by LRN. And we'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Principled Podcast is brought to you by LRN. At LRN, our mission is to inspire principled performance in global organizations by helping them foster winning, ethical cultures rooted in sustainable values. Please visit us at LRN.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review.